Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Welcome one and all on this fine summer's day on which I'm recording this episode of the Fergan podcast here in England. Summer got off to quite a late start over here, but it's here, arrived with a vengeance now. And I spent this morning out with my family paddling and dunking ourselves in a really idyllic mountain stream nearby. So it's been a good day so far. This is going to be a solo recording, and it will probably be a fairly short one because in order to get good audio quality, I'm having to shut myself in my little office with my little desk fan on in an attempt to shut out the noise of the nearby road. So it's going to start sweltering in here quite quickly. So I don't want to be sat here too long, and I hope you can understand that. So this episode is going to touch on a few things surrounding paganism and Christianity and Gnosticism. Firstly, I just want to make a kind of final comment on the Pagan Futures conference that I participated in along with Tom Rousell of Survive the Jive and Borja Villalonga. The event was an enormous success, and you know, perhaps at some point I'll do kind of like an appraisal of the a retrospective of the event and let you all know how it went. In summary, it went really quite well. I would say near perfect, but sadly, in the weeks since it happened, it would appear that there is still a faction of the pagan right, I suppose we can call them, who are deeply dissatisfied with the way that the event took place because one of the speakers, Borja Villalonga, happens to have once been a convert to Judaism and is now a Neoplatonist and is married to a Jewish woman. So I've made quite a few comments on my channel, and to be honest, I really didn't want to make any further ones, but there's one further thing I did want to say, and that's just to remind everyone that this event was called Pagan Futures. It was for pagans. It wasn't specifically for Germanic heathens. It wasn't specifically for Slavic pagans or Celtic pagans or any specific tradition within the wider pagan framework. As far as I'm concerned, and as far as I was always concerned, it was an event for polytheists of any and all types. So, firstly, the fact that Borja is a Neoplatonist and comes from that perspective, that doesn't mean that everyone at the event, and certainly not myself, are in favour of Platonism. Not at all. Furthermore, Borja has stated unequivocally that he is not ethnically Jewish, and I see no reason to doubt him when he says that. I found him privately to be a very pleasant guy, and I thought his speech was very good. But let's say that he was Jewish. Do ethnic Jews not have a polytheism of their own? I think you'll find that if you look back into history, that they can, and they did. And that actually ties quite well into the rest of what I'm going to be talking about in this episode. And I'll get to that. But my point being here, this was an event to share ideas on paganism and, you know, more broadly, polytheism. Now, you could say that this was specifically for European pagans, and as far as I know, all involved were European pagans. But strictly speaking, it could have been pagans from anywhere in the world. And was it an event to promote folkish paganism? Yes, absolutely. But anyone from any nation of the world can be folkish about their ancestral religion, including those of Hebrew ethnicity. I mean, this is a moot point because Borgia himself is not even ethnically Hebrew. But I just felt that that was worth mentioning because the critics of the event, who will probably never be satisfied, have acted as though this was a specifically... To be honest, they've acted as though this was a political event. They've acted as though this was some kind of nationalist rally. It wasn't. It was a conference to discuss pagan ideas. I think that's a point that's been missed, and it's one that I wanted to make. And I am a folkish heathen. That has been the case for many years, probably far longer than any of the critics have even dabbled in paganism. I have not and will never relinquish that worldview or those beliefs. It would just seem that the critics of the event took a very different view of what the event was meant to be and what it was meant to portray than I did, or and perhaps even what Tom Rousel of Survive the Jive and Borgia Villalonga did. But as I said, these people, they look for any opportunity to criticise anyone doing anything meaningful in real life. They are not willing to... sit at a table with others who have differing views. As far as they're concerned, that somehow taints you. And I have to wonder how weak you'd have to be in your belief system to think that merely by conversing with someone of a differing viewpoint, you are therefore being infected by their viewpoint. And again, that word infection ties quite nicely into what the rest of this episode is going to be about. Excuse me while I take a sip of water. I probably have to do that quite a bit. It's quite warm in here. This is Tuesday the 19th of July, which is a day when Britain is seeing rare temperatures in the mid-30s and above, Celsius that is. So we're not really used to this kind of temperature here. And although it's not cripplingly hot, it's a little bit uncomfortable to be shut in a wooden garden office, which is where I do my recordings. So to move on from this discussion of pagan futures somewhat, a good segue here. One of the critics who specifically addressed me has accused me of being subversive because of my, as he called it, flirtations with Gnosticism. Now, funnily enough, even before these criticisms came in, I was going to discuss exactly what I'm about to discuss anyway. I had this episode lined up due to a private conversation that I had last week with John Lamb Lash, who is the Gnostic scholar who featured in episode 8 of the Fergan podcast. So if you've not listened to that episode, I would strongly recommend that you do so for the remainder of this episode to make much sense to you. Now, that episode was titled Gnostic Paganism, and in some small sense, it served as an attempt to reconcile the Gnostic worldview with the pagan worldview. Now, this is something that's been on my mind for many years, something that I've been formulating for a long time, And something which I'm very much still formulating, and I may at times have been barking up the wrong tree, but nevertheless, at all times, I have attempted to be intellectually honest about my investigations. For example, where I have sought to find comparisons and similarities between the Gnostic law and the Northern European pagan law of my ancestors, sometimes I've found clear evidence of similarities there. For example, I strongly believe that Althumbla, of the primeval cow of the Eddas, is cognate with the goddess Sophia of Gnostic law, the essentially Mother Earth, the provider, the genesis of this Midgard, this realm, this earthly material realm which we inhabit. In other areas, I've attempted to find correlations between the Gnostic view and the pagan view, specifically the Germanic heathen view, and failed to do so. Now, this is something that, before we recorded podcast number 8, John Lash, Rob Miller, and myself talked privately, and John raised concerns about doing this, which I heeded. Although he believes that Gnosticism is fundamentally pagan, he didn't think that put forward the strong belief that there are aspects of Gnostic law which are unique to Gnostic law, and particularly that Gnostic law is more similar to Greek paganism than it would be to Northern European paganism due to the geographical proximity of the two traditions. So I did approach this with some caution, but at the same time I'm leaving the door open to find these similarities. Now, you may be asking why I think it's important to find these similarities. I'm going to attempt to explain that now. Gnosticism is something which I've been interested in for almost as long as I have been a heathen, as long as I've been Arsitru. And the reason for that, initially I was fascinated by this Gnostic Luciferianism from a kind of detached point of view. That certain bands that I listened to at the time, and they very much held the kind of the popular, I would say, misconception of Gnosticism as this view of the material realm being evil, of it being like a prison of the flesh, within which divine sparks are trapped within the cosmos. I found this idea fascinating. It's not a belief system that I adopted myself, but it's something which I did look into out of sheer curiosity. A few years later, I came across John Lash's book, Not in His Image, that was a book which caused light bulbs to flick on above my head. You know, something about that book really resonated with me. I was already a heathen at the time. And why exactly did this book resonate with me? Well, firstly, John defies this commonly held view of Gnosticism as being anti-cosmic, and believes that actually this was a form of slander which came to us primarily through the writing Against Heresies by Irenaeus, the Christian scholar who was famously anti-Gnostic. John puts forth in Not in His Image excellent evidence to the contrary, that in fact the Gnostics held this material realm as utterly sacred. And in the podcast episode number 8, myself, Rob Miller, and John Lash gave some good reasons why this must be so. I'm not going to go through them now, but if you go back and listen to that episode, you'll hear, you know, what we put across. Now, this is one of the reasons that the book resonated so well with me, because it's life-affirming in the same way that heathenry is life-affirming, paganism is. You know, we cherish this natural realm. It's sacred to us. We are thankful for our biological inheritance that we have. We don't, you know, we don't dismiss it as some kind of curse, you know, as some kind of original sin. Ironically, I would say that it's the Christians who have this idea of transcendence, this idea that the earthly realm is a poor kind of staging ground for heaven. In my view, and it's not necessarily a view that all heathens or pagans hold, I believe this realm, this material realm, to be one of several realms, each of a different kind of vibrational reality. And all of them are sacred in their own way. None is more important than the other. And in fact, our earthly existence is actually vitally important in the grand scheme of things, in the grand schemes of the gods. I believe that there are entities who would love for nothing more than to be able to manifest materially as we do. You know, we have a gift in being able to do so. So this is the, you know, one reason which caused Not in His Image to resonate strongly with me. The other main reason, and this goes back to my introduction to John Lash's work, which was the Red Ice interview he did titled White Genocide and the Archontic Infection. Now this blew my mind, and I've shared it on my Telegram channel once or twice. What John puts forth in this episode, in this talk that he does with Henrik of Red Ice, is the idea that the Archons, which is an idea central to Gnostic lore, and one which John specifically has done probably more work than anyone else to bring to light, particularly to dissident spheres. And now you have the likes of David Icke and Jay Widener and others who talk about the Archons, and it was John who really introduced that word into the discourse. Now, the concept of the Archons is something within me connected with this. I knew that there was something to this. The Archons being etymologically, Archon means ruler. But the way that John puts the idea across is that the Archons are these kind of otherworldly, invisible entities which have no creative divine spark of their own. And seek to confuse and deceive us. They are the agents of the decay and degradation that we see going on in the world around us. Essentially, I mean, you could, from a Christian point of view, they would probably be seen as demons. From a heathen point of view, they could perhaps be seen as the Jotuns or the Eotuns. This is a connection that I have looked into between Gnostic and heathen lore, and will continue to do so. There may be nothing there, and if there isn't, you know, this is something I should have mentioned before. Where I find no connection, no correlation between Gnostic and heathen lore, I am more than happy to put it to bed, to dismiss it. I am not trying to shoehorn anything into our ancestral faith whatsoever. I'm not trying to subvert it, to change it, to introduce anything foreign or unwanted into it. So where I find something which doesn't correlate, it gets dismissed, no problem. This may be the case with the Archons. It may not. You know, I think that's yet to be seen. Nevertheless, the reason that... Let's assume, for the purpose of this discussion, and here I'm going to go into... detailing, or rather concisely detailing, the conversation that John Lash and I had in private last week. And I have to credit John for this realization. You know, this is mostly his gnosis here that I am attempting to convey to you all. The reason that even if the Archons are not a reality in ancient Germanic heathen lore, yet are still relevant to heathens today, is entirely because of the Christian conversion of Europe and Northern Europe. Had Europe never been Christianized, we would not even need to know about this archontic infection, this archontic threat. The reason for that is because, as John says, the archontic infection is transmitted through, originally through Judaism, via Christianity, through the Abrahamic religions, and has thus been transmitted to Europeans of the modern age. An idea which I think it was Rob Miller suggested is that actually this transmission comes through the language, and merely knowing the language of the Abrahamic religions is what causes us to be infected by this archontic anti-natural force. I know this may sound kind of out there to some of you listening. Hopefully not too much. I mean, I don't see anything in what I'm saying which is outlandish in the context of a sincere pagan worldview. We believe in otherworldly entities. We believe in entities that we can't see. We believe that certain entities are specific to certain locations, certain geographical locations. So could it not be that this kind of demonic archontic infection, and I use the word demonic reservedly there because I know that in certain traditions, demon etymologically derives from a good entity, not a bad one. But just to use the kind of common parlance, the common, verbiage, this idea that these otherworldly entities could have come to influence us via this extremely powerful belief system, which arrived on our shores about 1800 years ago or so in northwestern Europe, and later actually in the far north of Europe. This is why I think it's important for pagans to know about aspects of Gnostic lore, because only through understanding this can we understand the grave danger posed to us by the Abrahamic religions. Now, at this point, I'm going to offer a disclaimer. I don't know how many Christians listen to this podcast. There may be a couple of you. You're very welcome. I don't have any issue with you as a Christian, but I do have an enormous issue with Christianity. I know that you will find this offensive, but I have to be honest about this because I believe it is of grave importance. So know that I am not attacking you. I know that there are many wonderful, courageous, upstanding Christians out there who are very much fighting the good fight. And I value you, and I hope that in return you will consider the words that I am saying. For the rest of you, you shouldn't be too offended by anything I'm about to say. But essentially, Europe has been infected by Judeo-Christianity. And Judeo-Christianity has served as a vehicle for a grand deception, a rot, a cancer, which has embedded itself deeply within the European peoples and our psyche. Were we still pagan, we wouldn't be decaying in the manner that we currently are. We would be withstanding all of the threats that are coming at us, from a purely kind of political, socio-political angle. We need to know about, I believe we need to know about the Archons and this aspect of the Gnostic narrative, because it highlights it's as John Lash said, it diagnoses our sickness. It diagnoses our illness. It uncovers the core key problem that we're facing. So, in a sense, Gnosticism is a useful antidote to this subversion and attempted eradication of our natural, native faith and way of being. It serves as an antidote to that, but not as a replacement for it. That is, in a nutshell, what John and I have been trying to get across. It's just that we were able to elucidate more on it after discussing the matter further. And I think John will agree that this is an important statement to get out there. And John and I will be doing episodes of the podcast in the future, you know, probably not on the connections between Gnosticism and paganism, although that might come up if it's relevant and we believe it's a sound correlation that we found. But there are other aspects which John is highly knowledgeable on other aspects. You know, he's knowledgeable on our pagan mythos and our socio-political situation. So there are various other things that we can and will discuss. So, Christianity, Judeo-Christianity. Now, I'll start by reminding everyone that the Old Testament is part of the Christian corpus. The Old Testament is derived from the Torah, or I think perhaps it's more accurate to say that the Torah is derived from the Old Testament. I think there are some books of the Old Testament which aren't included in the Torah. Nevertheless, there is a shared sacred text there between Judaism and Christianity. And by the way, I'll add another disclaimer here. When I talk about Jews or Judaism, I'm not commenting on the Jews as an ethnic group. I'm talking about the religion in the same way that I'm talking about Christianity. For the purpose of this podcast, when I say Jews, I'm talking about the practitioners and originators of the Jewish religion. When I talk about Christians, obviously I'm talking about practitioners of the Christian religion. So they share a book. This is why I, no matter what Christian nationalists, Christian identitarians try to say, Judeo-Christianity is a legitimate term. And I don't see how anyone can argue that. Judaism gave us the book Deuteronomy. The verse in Deuteronomy 12, lines 2 to 3, goes as follows. Destroy completely all the places on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every spreading tree, where the nations, that means the pagans, you are dispossessing, worship their gods. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones and burn their Asherah poles in the fire. Cut down the idols of their gods and wipe out their names from those places. So there is a declaration, Christians would say, from the mouth of their very God, Yahweh. There is a declaration, an instruction to destroy pagan temples and the pagan way of life. Okay, need I go on any further? This Judeo-Christianity was an attack upon Europe. We already had our own native ways. We had our own instinctive way of living in harmony with the land, with the whites and the gods of our lands. We respected Mother Nature. We did not allow perverse practices or weaknesses other than the weakness of Christianity. The weakness which allowed Christianity, which at the time was strong and warlike, into our societies. When we did, that's when we were infected, I believe, by this archontic infection. Things have gone south ever since, as far as I'm concerned. We can look at Hypatia. Hypatia, the Egyptian Neoplatonist who died in 415. This is an event which John Lash talks about in Not in His Image, so I thought it was fitting to discuss it here. I'll just read from Wikipedia what occurred surrounding her murder. During the Christian season of Lent in March 415, a mob of Christians under the leadership of a lector named Peter raided Hypatia's carriage as she was travelling home. They dragged her into a building known as the Caesarion, a former pagan temple and centre of the Roman imperial cult in Alexandria that had been converted into a Christian church. There, the mob stripped Hypatia naked and murdered her using a straka, which can either be translated as roof tiles or oyster shells. Damascius adds that they also cut out her eyeballs. They tore her body into pieces and dragged her limbs through the town to a place called Canarion, where they set her, where they set them on fire. Now, this gruesome description of a mob of Christians murdering, slaughtering, disembodying a pagan Neoplatonist, Hypatia, who was well loved in her time. I mean, it sends chills down your spine just to read it to this day. Now, it is suggested that her murder was more political than religious, but I would say with near certainty that the mob of Christians who were enlisted to do this to her were compelled and propelled to do so by their Christian zealotry. Now, zealotry or zealot or zealous is another interesting word to consider. It comes from an original word meaning one who is adamant on behalf of God. Now, this describes the Abrahamic religions. They are religions of conversion. Religions of conversion are Arkontic religions, and they also happen to be the Abrahamic religions. So they are the religions that arose from a Hebrew origin in the Middle East and spread into our native lands, burnt and deconstructed our temples, placed churches upon them, defaced pagan statues. I've got a web page up here which lists a horrific Christian atrocity for almost every decade from the 4th century onwards. In 314, the Christian church attacks the Gentiles. The Council of Ancyra denounces the worship of goddess Artemis. The Emperor Constantine declares Christianity as the only official religion. Constantine, following the instructions of his mother Helen, destroys the temple of the god Asclepius. I could go on and on. Flavius Julius persecutes all the soothsayers and the Hellenists. Many Gentile Hellens are either imprisoned or executed. An edict of Constantius orders the closing of all pagan temples. You can tell that I'm not very used to used to reading out loud Greek and Roman names. Classic literature and history is not something that I am particularly well versed in. It goes on and on. I could spend the next 20 minutes reading examples of the first millennium of Christianity, of persecutions against Mediterranean pagans. Then we have St. Boniface, to our eternal shame, an Anglo-Saxon who acted as a missionary to the Germanic parts of the Frankish Empire in the 8th century. He is responsible for the felling of the Donar oak, the Thunor or Thor oak in Germany, near the present-day town of Fritzlar in northern Hesse. According to his early biographer Willibald, Boniface started to chop the oak down when suddenly a great wind, as if by miracle, blew the ancient oak over. When the gods did not strike him down, the people were amazed and converted to Christianity. This is what they claim anyway. Just as a slight anecdote, my uncle, one of my English uncles, built a house, a brand new house, and named it St. Boniface. He is an Anglican. He is a Christian. I'm not sure how pious and devout he really is, but he likes to act as though he is. Needless to say, I've not spoken to him in many years. He and I share entirely different worldviews. Furthermore, what do we have? I could go on for a long time about examples of Christian persecution of pagans and violence towards pagans and the destruction of our temples and our way of life, criminalization through their unnatural laws of our way of life. This was, as far as I'm just trying to get the point across here, that Judeo-Christianity was a plague which ravaged Europe and destroyed our native ways. And Gnosticism is uniquely positioned to help us identify the extent of the threat that Judeo-Christianity poses to our way of life. That's why Not in His Image by John Lash resonated so strongly with me. That's why I am still, I still have a strong interest in Gnosticism. But my allegiance is, of course, to my ancestral tradition. And, you know, John, when John and I spoke about this, he said, absolutely, Europeans should be reverting, should be returning to our native ancestral faith, not to Gnosticism. We absolutely should be doing that. And he, you know, what we agreed, as I've tried to get across in this, is that Gnosticism serves as a kind of a temporary diagnosis tool, you know, like a, let's consider it a helping hand from the, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean region, where the ideas of Gnosticism arose from primarily. Another, you know, one of the claims that Christians like to make about pagan Europe is that we had no morality. I've dug up a couple of what I think to be very good and pertinent quotes on this. Marcus Aurelius: "Nature has constituted rational beings for their own mutual benefit, each to help his fellows according to their worth, and in no wise to do them harm." So Marcus Aurelius is getting across here the fact that we are naturally inclined to be good to our fellow man, to act morally to our fellow man, particularly those who are within our tribe, those who upon whom we depend and who depend on us. We didn't need Christianity to instill morals in us, as if we were barbaric, sacrificing savages who had absolutely no concept of civilization or goodness or objective goodness or tribal goodness or any of these things before Christianity came along. It's utter nonsense. Another quote that I want to read from Arne Næss, the Norwegian philosopher and ecologist, who I think coined the term deep ecology. "We need not morals to make us breathe. If your self, in the wide sense, embraces another being, you need no moral exhortation to show care. You care for yourself without feeling any moral pressure to do it, provided you have not succumbed to a neurosis of some kind, developing self-destructive tendencies or hating yourself." Now, this neurosis he speaks of, what could that be other than Judeo-Christianity? The self-destructive tendencies which come about through not only believing or being taught through this foreign religion that we are born in some kind of original sin, but that in fact there is another tribe of people who are God's chosen and that the rest of us are not God's chosen. That we are supposed to worship a God who doesn't even value us in the same way that he values others. That's quite simply because Yahweh is a tribal God. He is not the God of our people. He never was. He never should have been. But through the conversion practices, the violence and the missionary practices of the early Christians and perhaps the early Jews, the Jews of early Christianity, this neurosis, this archontic infection spread into our realms. I don't believe we can ever find true dignity or freedom again until we restore our native practices, our native way of life, our paganism. Another thing I'd like to mention here, and this refers to a discussion that I've been having with a new friend of mine called Adam. This is something that came about through our mutual interest in the Mandela effect. One of the aspects of the Mandela effect, one of the Mandela effects, so to speak, is that most people believe the famous line from the Bible being that the lion lays down with the lamb. This is, this is how I've always known it. Yet, if you now pick up a Bible and find where that line should have been, it says the wolf will lay down with the lamb. I mean, this is anecdotal sense. The reason I mention it is because apparently, I wasn't aware of this, but according to Adam, who I've been discussing this with, there is a belief among certain Christians and Jews that this lion, the lion lays down with the lamb, referred to the Lion of Judah, i.e. the Lion of David, of King David, which is the line from which Jews believe their Moshiach, their Messiah, their true Messiah, will arise. That the lion represents this, the Lion of David, the new Messiah, and that the lamb represents Yeshua, Jesus Christ. That the lion laying down with the lamb is symbolic of these two entities converging in one, and that Jews will realize that Jesus really is the Messiah, and Christians will accept that Jesus is also the Jewish Messiah, that there will be this common Messiah between the two supposedly rivaling faiths. This is just, I mentioned this just as an example of how closely knit Christianity and Judaism really are. And this isn't even necessarily to denigrate Judaism. The reason that Judaism is an issue to me primarily is because it's not our indigenous faith. It doesn't belong in Europe. It never has, and nor should its offshoots. We had our own way of life, which some of us are attempting to restore in Europe. We had our own way of life, which sprung from within our people, from our own soil. This is the only natural way for us to be. I'm going to leave it there, even though I could probably ramble on for a while on this. Hopefully you've taken this episode in the spirit that it was intended and found it of interest. I'm not trying to ignite petty drama between Christians and pagans. In fact, I myself will be attempting to ignore the debate myself. I'm using my platform here to make some points which are important to me, which I believe are important to our people. And my inbox is open to anyone who would like to politely discuss this. But I'm not going to keep quiet about something as deeply significant as this out of an attempt to avoid drama. So I would suggest, you know, humbly, that anyone listening to this who feels as strongly about this as I do, don't bother engaging in these petty squabbles with Christians, particularly because they will always find some way to justify and reconcile their identitarian traditionalist nationalist viewpoint with their Christianity. You know, they come up with this "we were the real Israelites" nonsense and whatnot, and in my experience you just can't get through to them. They don't want to know, so they will always find some kind of, you know, obscure means of wriggling out of you know, the accusation. So I think the best thing that we can do is continue to become better pagans, to learn more about our own ancestral ways, to practice them as well as we can, as sincerely as we can, to connect with other pagans, to lead by example, to show those out there who are either on the fence or perhaps agnostics or atheists or even wobbling Christians, you know, not to actively try and convert them, but to show by example that we have something, you know, with an extreme depth of meaning, of power, that is entirely native to us, which belongs to us, which is our birthright, which offers us just as much as Christianity ever could, and way more. And all of this is within our native faith. And really, this is what this podcast is about. This is what the Fergan is about, largely, is trying to shine a light on misconceptions about paganism, to give people the confidence to return to it, to try and help beginners on their path towards this way of life, which they already know to be authentically theirs. So thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Fergan podcast. It was a little bit shorter than some of my episodes, other episodes have been, but actually a little bit longer than I expected it to be. But I hope you've enjoyed it nonetheless. And lastly, but not least, the answer to last week's riddle, read eloquently and evocatively in its original Old English form by Whityard, was wine. Wine was the answer to that one. And this week's riddle from the Exeter Riddle Book is as follows, in its modern English form. I travel by foot, trample the ground, the green fields, for as long as I live. Lifeless, I fetter dark Welshmen, sometimes their betters too. At times I give a warrior liquor from within me. At times a stately bride steps on me. Sometimes a slave girl, raven-haired, bought far from Wales, cradles and presses me. Some stupid, sozzled maidservant, she fills me with water on dark nights, warms me by the gleaming fire. On my breast she places a wanton hand and writhes about, then sweeps me against her dark declivity. What am I called who, alive, lay waste the land and, dead, serve humankind? So a slightly controversial one there, bringing up, raising a little bit of the old English versus Welsh, you know, rivalry. But I presumably the Welshman and Welshwoman referred to in that are symbolic of something else. And I'm not going to look up the answer now, but I will do in the next episode, and perhaps I'll discuss it a little bit there. So anyway, thank you all for listening, and I hope you all continue to enjoy your summer or your winter if you're in the Southern Hemisphere. And I shall speak to you in the next episode of the Fergan podcast.